Hey, everybody. We are here on This Bold Move Prestige podcast to talk about Moneyball, which came out almost exactly, if not exactly, depending on the day this came out, on its 10th anniversary. It's been kicking around for 10 years. Moneyball is a baseball slash math slash technocrat movie directed by Bennett Miller, who you might recognize as the director of Capote, which we have got a Bold Move podcast on, and Foxcatcher. I can't believe that movie came out in 2014. Seems like it just came out in 2018, but that's that wrestling movie that I've been wanting to see with Steve Carell. A lot of nose pieces in that movie. But yeah, Bennett Miller, based on a screenplay by Steve Zalian, who wrote Awakenings, Gangs of New York, and The Irishman, among others, and Aaron Sorkin, who is prolific, known for Sports Night, The West Wing, Newsroom, and also wrote the screenplay for a bunch of Hollywood gems, including A Few Good Men and The Social Network, that we, both of those are in the Bold Move archives if you want to check out our thoughts on those. Based on a story by Stan Chervin, which he based on the book Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game by Michael Lewis, who's written a bunch of shit like The Blind Side and The Big Short, which was also adapted into Hollywood films. Starring Brad Pitt. We fucking all know Brad Pitt. Jonah Hill. Twice the man that he is now in this film. Literally. Philip Seymour Hoffman, who plays like a 75-year-old tobacco-chewing baseball coach, is crazy. Robin Wright is there somewhere in the background. Chris Pratt is like, prior to falling into a pit in the Parks and Rec in his career, and he does a really good job. Nick Searchy, Bald Move fans will recognize him as Art from Justified. It's got a really nice cast, a lot of good character actors with a couple stars on top. I have never seen this film before, but I was really familiar with the material because I was a big fan of Bill Simmons while the Moneyball philosophy was sweeping through the NBA system.
Okay.
People desperate to look at these sabermetrics things and looking outside the box and, you know, what are the key metrics for basketball? Like, this shit's taken over the world in the last 20 years. So I'm interested in talking about it. What about you, Jim? Have you seen this film? What did you think?
Yeah, I have seen it before. I must have seen it pretty close to when it came out because it's been a very long time. And I remember when I watched it being very taken by the concept. Like, this is not your traditional sports movie. This is not like, the underdogs come from behind victory, although it is that. It's just, it's different. It's a come from behind victory based on statistics and probabilities and that kind of stuff, which appealed to me because I'm not the world's biggest sports fan, but I do have a lot of like tangential knowledge about sports just because my family was into it. I watched a lot of baseball as a kid because my parents would watch it all the time. I remember the era of Dave Justice, him playing for the Braves and all that stuff before he went to the Yankees. I remember all that stuff. Right. So it was like super interesting to me from that era to like see all this stuff behind the scenes and how like kind of, you know, the math and the money of it work. So I think conceptually it was like a really attractive movie. This second time I have a slightly different opinion on the movie because I came away from it the first time really liking it, just going, man, that was really good. The second time watching it through, I don't think it's quite as good. I think the concept and the stuff that appealed to me the first time around definitely still appealed to me and I get the draw of it, but everything else around the edges I think is half baked. I think the movie is worse for not just focusing up on the core concept and trying to like shoehorn in all these sort of Hollywood-esque drama tropes.
I guess I can kind of see, but I felt like it's shocking how little the movie has us, how little effort it makes in us caring about the main characters beyond the success of their philosophy. And I felt like there's already enough inherent drama about like, transforming a system that is entrenched and resistant to change and like, you know, going against these guys, like that stuff. Like, I don't need a daughter who is worried about her daddy getting fired from his executive football job. I don't need the, you know, newly married ex-wife and how we feel about that. Because, again, the movie doesn't care about this shit.
Like, that's what I mean by half-baked. It's like it doesn't go far enough in that direction to make it worthwhile, but it also still includes tidbits of it, so it's pointless.
I guess, and the movie is I guess it's a little long for what it is. It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes, you know, not including the credits. But like, if you take out those 5 minutes, it's a better film. But I guess I also could have watched
4 hours of the core concept. Like, I'm so attracted. It's such a unique, interesting thing that is the core concept that I wish they had. They could have made this into a series, and I would have been excited for it. But, you know, they also could have trimmed a bunch of shit out of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like the core concept, I guess, said is inherently interesting and stuff that I'm very interested in, stuff I choose to kind of read and look at on my own. And I thought the story was well told. Like, this is a tough story to tell about deep statistical analysis and trying to find the real data amongst the noise and the inherent conservatism that is built into the human DNA, and like how hard it is to overcome a prevalent point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so applicable to so many things in life. When I was watching this movie, like, this explains so many things. Like, anytime someone's swimming against the grain or bucking trends in society. And also not for terrible reasons. Like, I think it's good. Broadly speaking, the society is structured this way, so it's 10 times harder to change something than it is to like get people to just go along willy nilly with something sweeping that violates, you know, norms and conventional wisdom and things like that. It kind of should be hard to cause a revolution. But also how deeply frustrating it is when you're the one that's fighting. Like, there's a great line where it's like, you know, the first guy busting through the wall always gets bloody.
Yeah.
You know, and why that is. Like, it's such a brilliant, it talks about, like, there's things about employee management and, you know, leadership and economics and business that are pretty valuable. And I think it's amazing how well these things are delivered in like a 2 hour film.
Yeah.
And I think the film looks great. Mm-hmm. There's a couple scenes that I think are just are amazing in terms of filmmaking. Like, there's this one scene where I guess I wouldn't have the scene if it wasn't for the daughter, but they just contrasted, you know, Brad Pitt kind of like putting it all on the line reputational wise for his daughter, with him like angry driving on the interstate. And he's just like, the way they got that shot where it's like he's just in darkness, the car's in darkness, there's a bright light outside, but he is just like kind of like you know, the last sliver of a moon before it completely goes to new. Like, that's what Brad Pitt's face is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it's a beautiful shot. There's a couple things like that in terms of the stadiums, like, you know, like the way they're filmed, like cathedrals that are that your places of worship, and how you could easily contrast some place like Fenway to whatever shithole the Athletics apparently. I think they play in my uncle's 70s basement. I think that's the clubhouse of the Oakland A's is what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Just dank cinder block with wood paneling and shit.
Have you ever been on a baseball field, like on the diamond?
I have been on a baseball field in a stadium. Yes.
Okay. I was going to say, because the perspective you get like being at ground level there, like at home plate, because I've done this in the Padres stadium in Anaheim, and it's an experience. Like, when they shoot the Fenway Park shot where he walks out onto the field or whatever, and it's just like they're showing you the romance of it, right? The majesty of that field. And he's like, no offense to what you got going on there in bumfuck nowhere, but this is a baseball park.
This is a stadium.
It's right. Like, and every time like Chris Pratt would go up to bat, I'd be like, yeah, I get why this is crazy and nerve wracking. And you've got this big ass wall, hundreds and hundreds of feet out there. You've got this stadium full of people who are either going to boo you out of the room, or they're going to love you by the end of this 2 minutes you have at bat.
And it's immediate. 30,000 people screaming, yelling, booing, laughing, jeering at the second that you fuck up or succeed.
Right. There's an electricity to that, certainly, even just being in an empty park like Brad Pitt was in that shot. Yeah, they do a couple of really good shots like that impress upon you just like the romance of it, which is part of this movie.
Yeah, the fact that like it's, and that's why people love sports, right? Like, I don't like scripted television. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't like scripted reality. I don't like scripted sports. Like, I understand why people like wrestling, but it's kind of not for me. But like sports, when you're really into it, it's the perfect drama, man, because like anything could literally happen. Like egos humiliated, underdogs defeating Goliaths, you know, unstoppable juggernauts steamrolling their way, experiencing improbable defeats, fingertip catches leading to victory, you know, like just this fucking high drama. And it only works because people take it seriously, because if everybody in the world is kind of like, oh, well, we lost, better luck next year. But no, fucking cities get burned to the ground or are on sky, you know, on cloud nine for months at a time. And the people dress cosplay like it's, you know, like everyone fucking cosplays. It's usually in the context of their favorite, you know, major league team. Right.
Yeah, true.
This movie does a good job, even though these guys are people that hold that at one layer of remove, like at arm's length. Like, nope, it's not. It's all the, but you know, like, how can you not romanticize this game or any game?
I think it's strange though, sort of where it's inserted into the movie, because they get this streak going, right, where they're one game away, one win away from breaking the all time win record, and they have this 11-0 lead, and Brad Pitt's like turning around recklessly on the highway to go watch the game because he thinks it's an insurmountable lead. And then oops, over the course of like five innings, the Kansas City Royals, like Bo Jackson's not even on the team at the time, so like I don't know how they did this, but they come back and it may tie it up 11-11. And then there's this big drama about like, oh no, this team that has been moneyballed within an inch of its life is not going to break the world record for, well, world record. I don't know. They play baseball in America, right? Maybe Japan a little bit. But, you know, they're not going to break the all-time record for wins. Oh, no, wouldn't that be a tragedy? I'm like, I'm thinking, movie, 5 minutes ago, you were telling me that none of this shit mattered and any win or any loss on any given day means absolutely nothing. And now you're trying to turn around and tell me that I should be super invested in them winning this game. It's just not working. And then they flip it again right afterward. They flip it again and they say, yeah, it doesn't matter. A win means nothing. The record means nothing. I know they're trying to like show you that even the guys who pretend not to romanticize this also do. But I feel like the movie is a little schizophrenic in that way too.
Yeah, but I think it plays both sides, because I think real life is like that, you know, on things like when you're trying to buck a trend, like getting that 20 victory, like being more successful than any of the most loaded, hollowed lineups of all time that were hand selected by the fucking baseball gods that, you know, sucked Babe Ruth's dick and polished, you know, I don't know, Willie Mays' ball sack. You got those guys and you have made this Franken roster out of like spare parts and pocket lint, and you beat that record. That's important. But the thing about like bucking a trend is like 10 victories are worth one victory in the old system, and one loss is worth 10 losses, because it's like you see this time and time again with like, you know, female led action movies for the longest time. It's like every time there was a banger, people are like, ah, fuck it, it's an outlier. And every time you try to put a female lead in action here as a film, and it failed, well, if no one wants to go see a female action movie. Whereas like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger makes admittedly a couple bangers, but he also made a couple fucking stinkers. And every single time he made a shitty one, no one's like, ah, fucking, you know, people are tired of seeing him in. And it's because that's conventional wisdom. Right. And I think that's both sides. It's like that meant something. But like they played, and I think it's pretty probable, I think it's real audio from like local and national coverage, like when they, you know, this team that is again has a quarter, 25% or less of the money of the team that they're playing against gets beaten five games in the World Series. It's like, well, that just goes to show you that, yeah, maybe you can make some noise in a regular system and maybe you can get all the way deep into play, but you're never going to win a world championship. And if you can't win a world championship, even though one out of 32 teams get to do it every year, then you, with 75% of your money tied behind your back, then you ain't shit. People will say that with a straight face and being taken seriously because of the bias against the new system. And this...
Yeah, I feel like you have to have that,
even if you won, it doesn't, you like deep down in your pit of your stomach, you know, it means nothing because people still aren't taking you seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a strength of the movie.
And I do love when they start winning, right? They turn it around. They get this like 11 game losing streak at the beginning and everybody's writing them off. And then, oh, here we go. We've got 8 games in a row. Here we go. We got 16 games in a row. Oh, well, clearly it's all due to the coach, the art, right. Mandelfuck or whatever his name is, deserves all the credit here. Clearly he's turned this team around. And in reality, he's been fighting them every inch of the way. That's that to me was one of the better parts of the movie.
What I thought was interesting, before we get in a deep dive, maybe we should just tell people what this movie is about in case they want to watch it.
We should.
So this movie is about this concept that came out of the Oakland Athletics team in the late 90s, early aughts, called Moneyball, which was a reaction to the small. So like in there's a lot of sports that have salary caps where like every team has the exact same amount of money and you essentially play. It's kind of like a. You know, it's supposed to be fair. Like if you won the Super Bowl, then you get the last pick at the draft for talent next year and everyone's got the same amount of money. So everyone should, in theory, have kind of the same, amount of wax at the big prize. And it makes dynasties even more impressive, like, you know, what New England did with the Patriots. Baseball's not like that. Baseball, if you are New York City or you are Boston or someplace that's got a owner that's got a lot of money behind you. You can literally outspend. Mm-hmm. You know, the Yankees in this film have $140 million payroll. The Oakland Athletics have less than 40, like 38 million.
Yeah.
So like most of the time, the A's are just never, ever, ever, ever going to compete. And like, you know, even if they work their guts out and draft young players, as soon as those players become superstars, guess what? You know, like they said, we're being used. There's a line that's like, you know, we're being used as a heart transplant or as a like an organ harvesting operation for rich patients. You know,
mm-hmm.
We need a heart. They got a good one. Let's just tear it out. And what can they do to stop? We can't afford to pay these players. And it's a tale of Brad Pitt meeting Jonah Hill, which is this young economics grad from Yale. Who has this statistical way to look at baseball that goes beyond the talent scouts, these old crusty old men that see if guys pass the eye test and the arm test and the crotch sniffing test and all that kind of stuff to pick out players. And he's like, no, we're looking for people that baseball doesn't properly value.
Yeah.
You know, guys who are not, you know, and they essentially build a team that goes back to back to World Series, has a tremendous amount of success. And has changed the world of sports. Like this quickly spread to basketball. There's a lot of stuff in football that could be applied. But football is also one of the more conservative sports, which I want to talk about before we're done with this movie. But that's it. Can Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill with their spreadsheets and their win above replacement percentages, can they pick a team for $40 million that can beat a team that has four times that much money? And it's pretty compelling. Before we get into the rest of the movie, the really spoilery details, let's take a quick break. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah, well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
I think this movie, like, above and beyond it's what it is about this advanced statistical analysis of baseball, is also about how you can effectively change people's minds.
Sure.
And I was so frustrated because I haven't seen this movie, I haven't read this book, and I didn't know what Brad Pitt's character was all about. But like, he was very frustrating to me because in early goings of the movie, he's essentially just like, never explain ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're right. The other people are wrong. We're going to ram it down their throats. We're going to like, we're not going to get the owner's help to resolve a philosophical dispute between the team's manager and the front office. We're just going to play hardball. This guy doesn't want to play our players the way we want him. We're going to trade away all of his players. It seemed obviously head up your ass. Like, that's the opposite of how you want people to affect a radical change. And I wasn't sure, like, if it was character development or just the movie needing to finally exposit about what the fucking thing it was about. But he has this radical change in structure in the middle of the movie, where him and Jonah Hill start with bottom up from the players. Like, hey,
yeah,
you are batting 700. When you swing at these pitches, your percentage plummets to like below 100 when you're swinging at these edge cases. Stop swinging, asshole. The worst that'll happen is you get a walk, which puts you on base, and goes around to like all the different players and explaining like how you fit into the system to generate runs that eventually earn us points, that eventually win us games. And surprise, surprise, they started getting buy-in. Like,
this is why it's so frustrating. Like, one of my favorite parts of the movie is when Art starts getting all the credit for this, because he's the coach. He's supposed to be in the locker room doing this shit. He's supposed to be telling these people like, hey, you're doing this wrong. Fix this problem with your at bat and you'll get on base more. But he's fighting them. And you see that Brad Pitt, the general manager or whatever, has to come in and be the coach. And then Art gets all the credit for it. That was super frustrating.
But also, like, what is his deal? Why doesn't he? Because the guy's basically saying, look, man, you are doing this weird experiment and I got a 1-year contract and I got to like put this weird, like, I got to play all this weird positions. And what if we lose and I'm looking for a job this winter? I'm going to coach in a way that I can defend and be like, you know, just GM had this crazy idea. I did the best I could. And what would anyone else do? Like, it's a super high risk and high rewards, or super high risk, low reward strategy from this guy's perspective. It felt like the natural thing to do was just to get this guy a 3-year contract or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or bother to explain what you're trying to do. Like, right. Why did he just want to break? I don't know. Like, there was also something about like Brad Pitt not wanting to have personal relationships with players, not wanting to travel with the team, all that shit. Got reversed by the end of the movie, but I felt like that was the reason for the success as much as anything, and the movie doesn't really deal with that, you know.
Yeah, there's like that part in the middle where Art is fighting the change, and you kind of see the movie wants to make the comparison between like not getting into relationships with the players because you'll have to let them go or trade them or whatever. But then it goes right to the coaches with whom he is forced to have relationships. He has to talk to other managers and scouts and coaches. And he won't cut Art, which seems to be the thing to do, right? Get okay. If your coach is actively fighting you, sideline the coach, get somebody else in there. Like he has no problem promoting some fucking intern or something to head scout.
Just to humiliate the other scouts and show them that
right,
he's not
right,
fucking
who are also
bullshit.
Fighting him. But yeah. But he won't do it with Art. And I didn't know if that was some kind of them saying, oh, well, his relationship with Art is getting in the way of the pure money ball here and he should be doing that. But then, you know, he finds creative ways around it. But I didn't see why he didn't solve the problem by getting Art out of the picture, out of his way.
Right. I could like the owner all but said, what is like, you know, oh, this is your goal. Well, what's your obstacle? The goal would be like, well, you know, me and the coach don't see eye to eye. And it's not like asking the remote manager to settle the I mean, maybe that's just not done in baseball. But you know what else is not done in baseball? Trading all your stars like 3 weeks into the season
yes.
to force the coach to play the roster you want him to play. Like, what the fuck? You know, like. Oh, I'm sorry. It's going to hurt someone's feelings if you go and you tattletale to the owner. The owner wants to win, like make your case. And if the owner doesn't see it, then the owner doesn't see it. But like, it just is just weird. Like all this boardroom swashbuckling macho bullshit. Like I was mm-hmm. like, it was just starting to grate, especially since by the middle of the movie, that stuff all went away. But the movie didn't make a point to be like, oh, well, this isn't working. Because the other thing is like, it all worked against Brad Pitt's favor, his character, the general manager's favor, like the fact that he doesn't travel the team, the fact that he doesn't even watch publicly, doesn't watch the games. Mm-hmm. Like, look at this uninvolved cerebral egghead that is trying to do this stats based bullshit. He doesn't even give a fuck about the team. He's got no passion. He's got no heart. None of those are true, but he leaves himself open to these accusations because of the way he conducts himself. And like I said, I noticed there was a change, but I felt like maybe we could have stolen some of that pointless daughter scenes, the pointless ex-wife scene, and like put into like him realizing that he needed to dig deep and put because I just felt like he was asking so many other people that had much more skin on the game to put their careers and their livelihoods on the line. And he's kind of like, eh, well, you know, maybe I'll get fired. Maybe I'm not, you know, I got to.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I think the one thing, the human drama that this movie does focus on that pays off, I think, is Brad Pitt's former baseball career, where he's approached in the late 70s by talent scouts saying, hey, you've got real talent here. I want you to come play for the New York Mets. And he has to choose between doing that or going to Stanford.
Full boat. Yeah.
On a scholarship. Yeah. And he chooses to play baseball, and then he gets into the major leagues and just completely flounders. He can't hit. He can't do anything. He finds out this is just not for him because he's not as confident as he thought he'd be at bat. And so you've got this guy who I think is trying to keep himself from getting emotionally attached to the game as well. Like it's strange because like at some point he becomes a talent scout. And then he becomes the general manager of this team. Why is he doing that if he's trying to keep himself from becoming a real part of this game again? Why didn't he get into a different career? Why didn't he go do something else? Take all the money you made as a baseball player, because you were definitely making money even if you weren't good, and go to fucking Stanford after you're out.
Yeah, my only thing is like, I also thought the movie was nebulous about exactly what happened. Like, did he get drafted very highly, in which case he should have been very well paid?
Yeah.
Or did like he just not go? And no, I don't think that's true, because that was one of the tests he had for Jonah Hill. Is like, where would you draft me number one? And he goes, no, I would have picked you bottom of the ninth or whatever.
Even the guys with fucking nerve damage in their arms who can no longer do the thing that they've been paid to do and hired to do are still making like $250K a year. So it's not like any of these guys are going to be poor. You can take 1 year's salary and pay for your Stanford tuition. So
I
don't know why
agree.
He doesn't do that, but he didn't. In real life, right? Billy Bean is a real person, so you kind of have to go with that.
Right.
Although but there's the movie also, I thought does they take did liberties.
I thought they did a good job of explaining that when they had the talent coach have that speech about we're all told at some point that you got to stop playing the kids' games. Mm-hmm. Some of us get told that at 18. Some of us get told that at 40, you know, but it all happens. The question is, are you ready to have it happen to you right now? I think that explains why he got into baseball, because he probably did have enough money to go to Stanford. Doesn't seem like he's hurting for money. It's just that he had to, he couldn't hack the game. He wanted to be a scout because he wanted to, you know, keep being a part of the thing. It's the same reason, you know, the Roy Kent situation happened this yeah. season on the
for sure
Ted Lasso. Like, that's hard to give up that cheering and adulation. And
but then he keeps himself at arm's length, right, by not watching the games, by not talking with the players, by being a pure stats and, you know, results driven kind of guy. Which I don't know. I mean, the movie does a pretty good job at telling you that that's exactly what he's doing. He's got this emotional weakness, I think, for the game. And so he masks it with an emotional distance from the game, which I think, you know, because they show that he does have an emotional attachment to the game, that scene where Jonah Hill takes him into the video room and shows him this like 240-pound batter who like hits a home run, doesn't realize it, goes to first base, starts rounding it, trips over the base, ends up on his face, and then like army crawls back to the base to make sure he doesn't get tagged out. He doesn't even realize he hit a home run. I think that's why that scene works, because it cracks Billy's defenses. You know, he set up this emotional wall and this distance from the game, but man, you combine the record that they just broke, all-time baseball record, with then, like, you know, seeing Fenway Park and stuff, those wins, that series of like emotional highs, I think works pretty well, because you can tell that Billy is invested in the game. He just doesn't want to get too invested.
Yeah, and I guess that's the part that I'm having difficulty explaining, is that I thought there was a nice through line of like everyone getting on board with his philosophy, but also him making little concessions. There's a little bit of that, like the fact where he went to their aging star, their Roy Kent, and is like, you know, got his buy-in. Like, look, you know, I'm wanting you to be a leader. You know, like, you need to lose the ego, because you're not the 27-year-old phenom that got the $7 million contract. You're the guy that the Yankees paid me $3.5 million to take off their fucking hands. Mm-hmm. And you're essentially playing for free, from my perspective. But I, you know, you want to win more games, and I want to eke every last ounce of like, he made that. And also the idea that, like, OK, you can take this Moneyball philosophy too much, like to have your stars pay a buck for a soda.
Yeah.
It just start to seem like, you know, there's a difference between lean and mean and skinny and pissed. And when you're having these guys like have to pay for like their snacks and their, like, I've always thought that was horseshit. If you go through the break, like, especially, you know, this is the difference between like fucking blue collar and white collar. If I ever went into like an office job, a programming job, and there was like charging me a $1.50 for Cokes and stuff, I'd be like, the fuck is wrong with this place? They should have a fridge stocked with Mountain Dew. Like, caffeine equals productivity. What the hell? And like, sometimes outfits can get like too focused on that. But I felt like maybe, I don't know, maybe it was all show and no tell, and the fact that I got it at all, I felt like they needed a little bit more to show that, like, Brad Pitt had to change too. Like, the second it wasn't just the second he abandoned the stupid, just like wall, like iron curtain philosophy, and showed that, like, hey, I'm in this with you. I've got, like I said, skin in the game. I felt like the movie had a much, much more closer through line to the team kind of coming together and getting on board with everything.
And it showed also, I think it did a pretty good job of balancing the idea of Moneyball versus like a traditional approach, or like a people first approach, because you do need other skills aside from just stats analysis, right? You can pick all the right players based on how many do they get on base. You could do that all day, but then you get a guy like Jeremy Giambi. I only know anything about him because I've seen this movie, so maybe he's nothing like this, but he was clearly wrecking the team, right? He was causing all sorts of problems in the locker room, and he was just not supporting the team in the way they need to be supported. So you make a human decision here and you get rid of him. I think the movie shows that, like, okay, he might be the right guy in the Moneyball formula, but he's not the right guy in the locker room.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's stuff that you do, like, cause that's the thing is, like, I don't think the answer is to get rid of instincts and to get rid of the human factor.
Right.
It's just that it shouldn't be the only thing.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't be able to, like, and also it allows things like, well, they passed the eye candy test, which is essentially they look like a baseball player,
which is an economic concern, right?
This guy throws funny. I don't like him. Or this guy's got a big belly. Well, he's a catcher. You know,
you need him to get on base.
I love the big fat guys too, man.
Or the pitchers who like throw, you know, backwards and inside
out. Yeah.
I love that shit. That would make me go to a game. I don't know why they don't like the guys who throw funny if they're good.
My fondest years of a Colts are those times, those few years where we had an actual fucking jumbo package. We had a big fat fullback. We had a big hefty quarterback that you pull Peyton out of and you just fucking smash the goddamn ball and do the god. I don't know why the hell we ever never got because it's not like you pay an arm and a leg for a 300-pound fullback or whatever. I mean, damn. Like,
sidearm pitchers are eye candy to me. I love that shit.
Yeah, I think that, but it's like you've got this, and I read this article too when I was researching a film about like that this philosophy's gotten everywhere. And there's someone using it to critique like Navy recruitment or Navy promotion practices. That like one of the things that a naval officer requires in their paperwork is an up-to-date headshot.
Oh, what? Updated hand job?
A headshot.
Oh.
Because one of the criteria for evaluating officers is do they look like an officer? And like, what the fuck does an officer look like? You know,
you say that, but when we in the beginning of this movie, when Brad Pitt is talking with the owner of the Oakland A's, I looked at that guy and I said, that looks like a baseball team owner. That guy looks exactly like a fucking baseball team owner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, that's like that can like what is an officer like? You know, maybe you're like, well, we don't want to a fat slob. OK, because we are a war fighting, blah, blah, blah. But like. Probably officer looks pretty white, you know, pretty so like there's a lot of things that an officer might look like that have nothing to do with how officer like they are. And I think that was another thing is that, you know, you got these people judging people on like their charisma or like their pure like you see this in football all the time where people fall in love with arm strength and like, well, the guy's a basket fucking case, but he can throw the ball over the fucking mountains like Cousin Rico and Napoleon Dynamite. That kind of stuff, the fact that that was being overvalued. And that's a great scene in the beginning where you've got all these crusty old fucks and they're all talking about they got these like cutesy conventional wisdom sayings about this, that and the other. And it's and he's like, well, this is just bullshit. And the idea like, well, we lost this player, this $17 million player to the Yankees. We need to replace him. Like, well, you can't do that. Like, even if you could find the guy, we couldn't afford him. We have to think outside the box. I really like that. I just wish that the Schmovie had him do a little bit more, you know, instead of playing hardball with the coach, like take him. But I guess this movie is already kind of lacking in drama because since it is a real life, you know, if this was a Hollywood, pure Hollywood production, they would have won the World Series, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's only so many like, embellishments you can do here.
There's so like the real life is like they peaked with the 20-year run and the 20 game win streak and they got to the World Series twice in 2 years and. You know, that's pretty, but it's like, that isn't the structure of a real sports, like their world championship is essentially the 20 win streak, which the characters, main characters all immediately agree doesn't mean shit.
Mm-hmm.
So like they're, it's kind of amazing. It works with what they are left with. But like, even when I was frustrated with Brad Pitt, he's so charismatic that like, and funny with the shit he's saying to these old fuckers and like the, you know, also, I thought the other thing that this film does really well is show how fun it is to just wheel and deal.
Sure. I will admit I couldn't follow that scene.
Oh, I don't, but like the idea that like he's building advantages and like he's got, you know, this is where his like extreme remove from the players helps him. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, you know, like there's nothing more fun than to go into like a car dealer well armed with how much a car's worth, with like three solid offers from other dealers, and have them compete. And you don't give a shit whether you like, you don't, you're not in love with this car. This isn't a Corvette. This is just a fucking minivan. You're wanting the best price for it. It's tons of fun to wheel and deal over things that you're dispassionate about. You know, yeah. Like if you make it, it's not personal, it's just business, baby. Let the other guy or gal sweat and get flustered and you know. And I felt like that nails it, that when you actually get something like this complicated trade to pull off, and just like how fucking amazing it feels. Yeah. Yeah, made it, even if I couldn't quite follow, because I don't know the players and I don't know what they're trying. But broadly speaking, you know, he's offering this other team that's like 90% of the value of what they were wanting to get from this other team to make him pump the brakes on this other deal. So he's cut the knees off of that, and then he's I thought it was
selling players for future profit to buy the player needs now.
It was confusing. Yeah, to make the cash work. And mm-hmm. I don't know how that works. That's the other thing, is like, why doesn't baseball have a salary cap? Why do you, if you are a, you know, a small market team, why do you get excited because your team is never, ever, ever going to win the World Series? Or if you do, right, it's going to be one of those like 100-year exceptions that everybody gets, you know, excited about.
Cubs, although they're not a small market team. I don't know why the Cubs had such a bad run.
I don't bad know. Management. That's the other thing, is like, yeah, for sure, money can't win the game for you. Mm-hmm. But like, if you don't have enough money, you're probably not going to. Yeah, it's not a guarantee.
Lack of money can lose it for you.
It's a prerequisite, it seems like.
Seems like it. I don't know. I don't know why that's the case.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
You know what they need? They need to take Moneyball to Hollywood. I wonder how Brad Pitt would feel about a salary cap. Although I know he took a cut to get this movie made. He took a cut to his salary, which is probably astro-fucking-nomical. This movie cost $50 million to make. I'm sure at least 20% of that was going to Brad Pitt.
Probably.
It's hilarious to me as an actor to go in and play this, you know, Moneyball character when if they applied Moneyball to your profession, you could get like five Giamattis for one Pitt, right? And five Giamattis would make a hell of a cast.
The problem with that stuff is like, and it's funny because this is when I was a big sports fan and thus a big Bill Simmons fan. He used to talk about this all the time, like the fact that like River Phoenix dying makes Leonardo DiCaprio's career possible. Because Hollywood doesn't usually have like five Leonardo DiCaprio, like, you know, five of a particular blonde, chiseled, well, you know, like they usually have a couple of these slots. Like there's a couple of like the primo character actor slots. There's a couple primo leading man slots. It's not like there's like, you know, 36 Hollywood teams that have 22 players per roster and a farm team of 40. Like that's the old Hollywood system. But like the new system, it's like it's hard because like usually when Hollywood has a slot filled, that's it. Like in if you're the second best banana, then you're just just competing for whatever the other guy doesn't have time to do.
Well, I feel like, but you know, paying Brad Pitt $10 million or whatever he makes for film, you could probably pay a guy $8 million and get 95% of what Brad Pitt brings, or pay him $2 million and get 95% of what Brad Pitt brings, right? Yeah. I feel like there's some optimization they could do. I know it doesn't work that way, but that's what I mean. Like, you know, I always wonder about roles that actors take if they're thinking meta like that. Like, hey, if this were applied to what I'm doing right here and right now, how would I feel about it?
Well, so I want to talk about that because like this advanced statistical analysis, the end of the movie kind of has the dark flip of side of this coin. Mm-hmm. Which is, so Brad Pitt turned down the $17 million contract to go be general manager of the Reds and
Red Sox.
Or the Boston Red Sox, rather. Yeah. Shit. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of small market shit teams toiling in obscurity, the Reds. Yeah. But he gets he turns down that offer, and the movie helpfully informs us that 2 years later, the Boston Red Sox snapped their 100-year losing streak, the Bambino's curse, using the advanced statistical analysis pioneered by this guy. They just hired the next leading guy,
the guy who wrote the book on it, I think.
Did they? Yeah. Okay. So that sucks for Brad Pitt because he was vindicated, but now the rich guys are using it. And that's the thing. It's like once you get a big edge because all the big guys are using conventional wisdom and the old crusty eyeball approach, and they're missing a lot of things. So you get an advantage from doing that statistical analysis. But once everyone starts to do the statistical analysis, the edge disappears. And now you are just competing. The Red Sox and Yankees now know exactly how much the best players are worth and are not making mistakes. And now what does that leave a small? So like, do you work harder? You try to find ever slimmer edges? You can. But like, it's a race to the bottom.
It is.
And I feel like that's something I don't know what the answer is. And, but I'm looking at 2021 and I feel like a world of sabermetrics and just in time manufacturing has led us to like we used to have big fat cushions on things, important things like medical supplies and, you know, stuff like that. And now we have like this thin skin, like it's an apple. That's how much cushion we've got. And But the argument is like, well, you know, why would you not, if you find these advantages, why wouldn't you reek out every bit of money and efficiency you can in the system? Why would you like leave slack capacity on the off chance that something might happen? And I don't know, because that's a fucking good, compelling answer, too. Like, why would you be intentionally inefficient just so in case of war or fucking environmental catastrophe or pandemic or I don't know, all fucking three at the same time? You would have, you know, like people like you're not having food shortages and supply shortages. But that's the thing. It's like, so what is Brad Pitt's ultimate reward? Congratulations. You priced yourself out of the market and you turned down your chance to get rich. Yay.
You got your name in the history books, I guess, if you care about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that this movie, I think, ignores, though maybe not necessarily to its detriment, it is very much a cheerleader for Moneyball. It says Moneyball is the way of the future. Moneyball is how things should work and the best way for underdogs to get a leg up. It doesn't then follow that along and say, okay, what happens, like you said, when the bigger teams start doing the exact same thing? What happens to the players when they get money balled out of bigger salaries? Like, does this, what are the downsides to Moneyball, I guess, is the question I had coming out of this that they'd never even attempt to address in this movie.
I had questions like, too, like they're saying no bunts, okay, or, you know, and walks are fine and no stealing bases. And it's like, well, if you outlaw the funnest, the flashiest, most high drama aspects of the game,
yeah,
like is the is game that like that's the baseball? Thing when people said they're ruining the game, like maybe they are.
Mm-hmm.
But also maybe the game should be changed, the rules should be changed to keep the exciting things in, you know. But there again, that's like a constant frustration with me in football. There have been tons of statistical analysis done. It essentially says, in except for very rare cases, maybe pinned deep in your own territory, you should never, ever, ever punt the ball in football. The fact that the average play in football gains 3 yards, the fact that you only need 10 yards to get a first down, the fact that there's 4 downs in every set shows that, like, if you just, you're giving away 25% of your chances to get those 10 yards every time you punt. And a lot of times if you do, you know, they've got this thing of like percentage of chance to win a game. Like every time the team punts, like this, the computer spits out that they just massively, you know, gave away a big chunk of chance of winning the game. Mm-hmm. And with, I think there's been a few times, like I feel like Ron Rivera down in Jacksonville, like, or might have like experimented late in a failed season, not punting. But even then, he didn't go all the way because, like, you should. The key thing to doing a strategy like this is you got to do it all the fucking time.
Yeah.
There's a brilliant line in the movie where it's like, the percentages are in our favor, but it doesn't mean that every at bat is going to go our way. Just like when you're counting cards, it doesn't mean you're going to always win. Mm-hmm. It just means you have a 1.5% chance more of winning than losing. And over a long enough stretch, if you have a big enough pot, you won't bust and you'll take the casino. But a lot of people don't understand that. So like Ron would.
Yeah. When Jonah Hill says like, we don't have a large enough sample set. I was like, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt Okadawookie's in Chaz, a Riverboat Ron. That was his nickname that season. Cause he's like the riverboat gambler. He's like, but it's not a gamble. It's the sure fucking thing. And the first time a team commits to that.
Yeah.
To not, cause that's the thing that even Ron, like when the game was close and like, he would really feel the heat for a failed punt attempt. He mm-hmm. always reverted back to conventional wisdom, but that's where you're giving away. That's like playing, keeping the count, but then like disregarding it if the cards look really
down.
Good.
Right.
Exactly. Like it doesn't feel right.
You have to. That gives you the edge. That's the
thing. What gives
that's
you,
the whole
yeah,
ball game.
And not like, well, I'm going to count cards, but I'm not going to split when it's favorable to do so because
it's scary. You,
right. And like, there's going to be a guy that does that and it will change the game of football forever. They're probably do away with punting. There's a lot of reasons to do it. Like, you know, like if you want to punt, why not just like have an automatic 30-yard advancement on the other side? Then you don't have people getting, you know, these the highest velocity impacts is when people are kicking off and stuff. Like you just eliminate that part of the game. Punting sucks. It's all like, but nobody does it because football is one of the most fundamentally conservative sports in America.
When are we going to get rid of like active coaching during games? Cause I feel like you could just spit the play, put the plays into a computer and it could spit out the optimal play for you.
And is that what people want? Cause that's the thing is like, we're talking about
boring,
sports right now. Because mm-hmm. the other thing is like, how far do we apply this in real life?
Yes.
Like there's a lot of talk in like startup communities of like, you know, finding the underpaid executives and programmers and like what are, you know, what key metrics are we missing with employees that are you know, everyone's like, you know, they see a success of a startup. They're like, oh, how can we copy it? But like how much of this stuff that, you know, is interesting when in terms of winning a game that doesn't really matter, how much of this should we apply to real life?
And I think you can go too far with that. I'm not even talking about necessarily like hiring or promotion. I'm talking about mm-hmm. micromanaging things. Like you said, that thin skin philosophy, right? Of just optimizing to within an inch of its life. how far is too far? Because there's always a human element too, right? The Moneyball didn't work on its own. You had to have Dave Justice in there championing the team and, mm-hmm. and getting everybody to get on the same page and know each other. And you had to get rid of problem players. It wasn't something where statistics could solve every problem. So I feel like there is a tendency in modern society to go down these technological, almost robot-like avenues and mm-hmm. say that people are all the same and that every, you know, cog has its place in the machine, and that might not always work.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to see this in real time with, like, self-driving cars. Like, self-driving cars are almost certainly going to be safer than, you know, human-piloted cars, but every single time it involves a multiple fatality, a Tesla or whatever is involved in a multiple fatality in a highway, there's going to be people screaming for blood because the computers are killing people. 20,000 people die in this fucking a country every goddamn year to people texting and driving, drinking and driving, sleeping, you know, not getting enough rest, just doing stupid shit. But like the one time the computer fucks it, it's people are going to lose their mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like I said, for every 100 miles of safely driven road, no one's going to, you know, say anything. But like one single fatality, there is, like I said, that's like I think it's good. There must be a hell of a survival incentive for this stubborn conservative streak in the human nature, because it's good. Like, you know, if someone's like, hey, look at this fucking berries I found, guys, let's just fucking all eat them right now. Rejoice, we found a new type of red berry. Wait a minute, what if it's poison, John? I don't give a fuck. It's like, there's a good reason we probably don't just jump on the latest and greatest things, and we intensely favor things that worked for us in the past, and we abhor things that hurt us in the past. That's all good, but like,
well, we're also, you know, intuition and superstition based in a lot of cases where it's not warranted. And true. I think that self-driving car thing is like nail on the head, because there are just scopes of data and scopes of knowledge that the human brain is equipped to process well. And then there are scopes that are well outside that are just as valuable, but we can't quite get our meaty minds around them, right? You need some silicon in there to mm-hmm. process a huge amount of data in a way that organizes it and makes sense. And there is this gulf between what the human mind feels and intuits versus what could potentially be the reality of the situation, and bridging that gap, which is, I think, the most effective thing that this movie does, is it shows that bridge where it's results driven, right? Like, once you see it, you can look at all the data and you can look at all the numbers and say, yes, this on paper makes a ton of sense. But until you see the results that are based on that data, the human mind does not want to accept it. And that is becoming more and more of a problem. I mean, we're dealing with that problem right freaking now. We've got a pandemic going on where we could effectively eliminate this thing if everyone were willing to just go with the thing that science says makes sense, even if it doesn't make sense to them personally. And yet we're having a hard time overcoming that gap.
Yeah. It's like Jonah Hill says, the fundamental misunderstanding is that people have an imperfect understanding of where runs come from. We have an imperfect understanding of where a lot of things come from, and we are very bad at analyzing risk. And I mean, that's something that, like, I was a hobby horse of mine on my Three Right Turns podcast, but something I genuinely believe, like, if you want to do like Moneyball in your own personal life, just follow expert consensus.
Yeah.
Every time you have a question,
doing this every day,
like, where should you invest your money? Like, expert consensus says you should put it in 401k and IRA and mutual money market, and you shouldn't take
index
like wild
funds.
Swings on things like Bitcoin and AMC and GameStop. But, you know, people on the internet can say that. And like, you know, what should we do in a pandemic? You know, wearing masks and social distance and vaccination, or should we take, you know, anti-parasitics and stuff that's off-label use? If you know, and it's not to say like what they said is like, that doesn't mean every at-bat's going to go your way.
Right.
It's just you're doing the best to maximize your overall potential for success. Mm-hmm. And this just goes time and time again, like, how much should you pay for a house? There's formulas for that, you know? And the banks are not using those formulas. The banks are using how much they can get away with loaning you so they can maximize their return. But they're not thinking about maximizing your personal financial success or your family's financial success. they're not thinking about like, oh, they're going to be house poor and they're going to be able to take vacations and they're going to, like, if their fucking car explodes, they're going to lose their job. They just know that, like, so it's so many things in life and this world is so fucking complicated and it changes all the time. You're going to be way better off just following expert consensus than, you know, quote unquote, doing your own research and all that kind of stuff. Especially since most people don't know how to fucking research things properly.
Yeah.
So it's wild because, like, also like what you said, it's like, well, when are we going to get to the point where you don't have on-field coaching? It's just all put into a computer. And like, I don't know that we want that in sports, but, and I'm not sure we're ready for it in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we had a lot of experience with the planned economies in the 20th century and they didn't go too well. But like, what if there's a supercomputer that could accurately predict like demand curves for common household things and, you know, would make sure that we're not overproducing toilet paper or underproducing? Like, are we ready to trust that to the economy to that? Or would we rather just have like, you know, the quote unquote free market settle it? I don't know, but like those are even more interesting questions to like the self-driving car thing.
Yeah.
You know, and also like when you look back in the last 20 years with all the different recessions and market crashes and corrections, would a computer do a worse job? You know, it's not like the computer doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be better, whatever statistical model or thing. And like, you know, we don't have to like let the computer just completely do everything, but like, you know, like Brad Pitt says at this point, it's like, do you trust this system? Do you trust this process? Because Jonah, like, he's like, God, geez, when we're giving away all these players, like, oh my God, I don't know. Like, but like, that's the gut check. It's like, if you believe in this, then, you know, because if you don't, if you start, you know, if you start like trusting your gut or being scared, then you're giving away that statistical edge. You are no longer counting the cards. And that's when you get fucked. So
that line is weird. That line, there are a couple of like moments in this movie that don't quite hit like they should because they're sending mixed messages. And I think that's one of them, because one of the embellishments they made in this movie is that Jeremy Giambi and Pena, I don't remember his first name, were not traded at the same time. The one was traded before the other. Mm. And in the movie, they're traded for very different reasons, right? You could say that Pena is traded as a sacrifice to Moneyball, whereas Jeremy Giambi is traded in the exact opposite way. He's traded despite what Moneyball says. And so I feel like when you get to that moment where Brad Pitt asks, like, do you trust this process? He's talking about Pena, but he is not talking about Giambi. When you need him, if he's asking that question, to be talking about both of them. And I feel like if they hadn't had him trade, they needed him to trade both because it's a punch, right? It's a punch to Art. It's like, he's not trading just one player. He's trading two. Fuck, he's serious. But also it doesn't work narratively with the question that he asked Jonah Hill.
What do you think about Jonah Hill? Like, this guy has transformed himself from like essentially stoner sitcom guy to like serious act. Was this the start of the turn?
This is the first time I remember seeing him in anything serious. Yeah.
And he's great, but he's still using all of his, he's just being this like the straight man, you know, like in the sitcom. But I thought he's really good. There's a couple scenes where, you know, he has to fire the player and Brad Pitt, like, this is the good, you know, the good advice, business advice he got about, like, you know, keep it just one shot to the head rather than five shots to the chest. And like, he's funny, but he does this. He does Wolf of Wall Street. And like, of late, he's just been doing conventional kind of leading man stuff because he's transformed his body. He's worked on his craft. Pretty interesting actor.
Yeah, for sure.
And I wonder, like, do we have, because I saw him with Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is completely transformed in this film, too. Like, I didn't even recognize him the first couple seconds. I was like, holy shit. Because he's playing the oldest, crustiest, curmudgeonly, you know, baseball manager that you've ever seen. And he's wearing, you know, I always thought that's funny. Like, baseball, it's the one sport where the coach dresses up like the fucking players. He's wearing the uniform and he's got the athletic cup on. Like, come on, who are you?
Yeah, why the cup? I mean, a straight Tommy ball. Lasorda, you never know. Fat, you're standing in the belly dugout. Hanging out.
Yeah.
You get a foul.
But what do you think of Jonah Hill?
I like Jonah Hill. I haven't always liked Jonah Hill, but I would say, yeah, he's got an impressive career at this point. I'm trying to think of the last time I saw him. That Netflix series he did, the like one-off mini series about the pills and the weird.
Yeah, what was that?
I can't remember the name of that. It had like a one-word name.
Uh-huh. Was it like, Maniac? Like,
yeah, that I think that was it. Maniac. That was cool. And that's maybe the last time I saw him do anything that I can remember.
Yeah, I was actually looking at this thing, too, the last few things I've seen him in. And he's done a lot of voice work and stuff.
He's fantastic in Wolf of Wall Street. He's, aside from Leonardo DiCaprio, he's probably the best part of that movie.
He's pretty good in Hail. I remember him being pretty good in Hail Caesar. I haven't seen like War Dogs. Yeah, I don't know. It's just he's really good in this film. And it's just I like those guys that take that bend, like where they're not taken seriously. This guy's kind of like one step away from being Chris Farley. And, you know, now he's been in some of the most interesting stuff we've seen in the last decade or two. What do you think of Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Speaking of, say, like, Jonah Hill's character in this, Peter Brandt, or what, Brand, I don't know. Mm-hmm. He is himself an example of Moneyball, because the Cleveland Indians have him, right, at the time. And he's just sitting in a cubicle doing player analysis, but not the type. Every time he pipes up about Moneyball, they shut him down. Even though he's in the room where it happens, right? He's in there and he's kind of calling the shots on this. They're just not listening to his overall philosophy. They just want his pick on a specific player. And so Brad Pitt comes in and recognizes that he's being underpaid and the true value of Peter Brandt, and then brings him over to the Oakland A's. I thought that was a nice little microcosm of the whole thing.
Yeah, he's undervalued because of his pariah nature. And how, I guess the other thing is like how those environments are not conducive to new ideas. Like even Brad Pitt, who wanted to hear his idea, he's very circumspect because he knows like how verboten this knowledge is.
Yeah.
What do you think of Philip Seymour Hoffman?
He's great.
I couldn't believe like who cast him in this movie. I mean, he can do anything, but who thought that, like, you know what? Fucking let's make him a baseball manager.
And shave his head. He looks just like the guy. I don't know if you saw a picture of the real.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. He could be anywhere. He's one of those old crusty dudes with the buzz cut that could, you know, he looks like Hank Hill's dad. He could be anywhere from 50 to 90.
Yeah, and, he's
you know,
great.
This was one of his last, you know, like not tippy tap last roles, but he dies less than 3 years later. And he's just amazing in everything. And he's so good at playing. Like I said, I don't think he's a bad guy.
No,
he's just trying to maximize his value. And like this guy's doing some crazy shit and sticking him with the team that he doesn't believe in. And if it fails, because that's the thing, he got all the credit, but he also would have gotten a good part of the blame if he just unironically plays this guy's Moneyball strategy. Everybody would have hated it.
So yeah, he said he's just trying to play a team that he can defend in interviews the next season.
Yeah, because like, when I'm being interviewed this winter, I want to be able to say, well, you know, obviously I was dealt this bad hand and you know how that guy's. But I thought that he played it because this guy is the closest thing to the film's got to a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have really ramped up that. But I always felt this guy like, you know, he's playing hardball, but he kind of has to. And then the thing that the Brad Pitt character, like Billy Beane, like what the fuck are you playing hardball? But I liked it and I was very shocked and surprised when I saw him in this movie.
The other guy I was shocked and surprised to see was such a big part of this movie is Chris Pratt. He's had a similar, you know, varied run that like Jonah Hill has had where he, I guess, was trying to be pretty serious. I read that during the interview or the auditions for this movie, they told Chris Pratt, hey, you're just too big to play this baseball player. So he dropped 30 pounds and came back months and got the part.
Because he wasn't beefy. He was just kind of like baseball lanky in this movie.
For sure. And then he goes on to do Parks and Rec was after this, right?
I think so. Yeah. Or during? Ooh, no, it had to be after.
Yeah, it had to be after. So then he goes, you know, and does, he does this drama, and then he does this very, you know, comedic role and gains some weight back, I think.
This was in the middle. Like, he was two seasons in to playing Fat Andy Dwyer in Parks and Rec. So he lost the weight, gained the weight, then lost the weight and got buff. Because that he didn't take the serious character actor. He went to the fucking buff dreamboat leading man Marvel career arc.
Yeah, the Chris Hemsworth.
So many men are taking today. Yeah.
Yeah. Kumail Nanjiani following in his footsteps.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wild just to see some of these guys in this earlier example of like serious work when I think of them mostly as comedians.
Another good casting is the 18-year-old Brad Pitt they got to play him. I didn't think it was much like when there's the close-ups in the face, but there's this part where he's like walking with his head down in the rain and he's got like the Brad Pitt mannerisms, because Brad Pitt is he's like a lanky Timothy Oliphant type, and he's got that kind of a little bit of Clint Eastwood strut to him, and that kid nailed it. Like, yeah, I was amazed at how well he looked like an 18-year-old Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I think they did a bad job casting for like the face. I didn't think, especially when you get to, okay, they start in 1979 with his recruitment, and then they go to like 1989 or something. He's got to be like almost 30 at that point, and he still doesn't look anything like Brad Pitt in the face.
I think they could have done some put Brad Pitt in the uniform when he's 30.
Like, I think you're right. Yeah,
he pulled off the 18-year-old, but other than that, it was tough. I thought there was a lot of good, just kind of like life advice. This felt like reading a good kind of like good management book. Because I think those things are actually valuable. Like, I learned a lot in the different, like, you know, management junkets and like professional career books that I've been recommended to read. But like, there's a lot of kind of like Sun Tzu, like, you know, well, what if the other guys are bunting and all that? It's like, then they're making a mistake. Rejoice in the fact that the other team has given you a 7%, you know, advantage. It's like if Vegas dealer's not reshuffling his shoe and you're counting cards, like, fuck, you know, whistle to the bank when you see that stuff happening. I thought that stuff, there's like a little bit of phrases here and there that really get at the heart of like some leadership and management that I thought was pretty nice. It's not, like I said, the first half of this movie is not any way I would ever try to shepherd change into an organization.
Right.
It's actually like how you want to get mistrust and internal division and sabotage. But like from the halfway point on, it's a really good way to show like how to build, you know, build your team up and build their confidence and get them on board the system, assure them. Cause like, again, not every bat's going to go your way. You're trying to go for the aggregate, you know, keep your eyes on the prize. It's not bad to take a walk. All that stuff was pretty good. I liked it.
Yeah. I guess I think I know why this movie is so highly rated, because it's got a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. It got nominated for 6 Academy Awards, didn't win any, but Roger Ebert gave it like a perfect 4-star review when he saw it. I think that comes down entirely, and I remember how I felt about this movie the first time I watched it, entirely to the concept, the core central idea of Moneyball, and how well, you know, the screenwriters sort of adapted that to the screen. I think that part works really well. Overall, I think this movie is mediocre. Because of the extra shit it tries to do, I think it sends mixed messages. It has this useless stuff with his daughter that they don't need anywhere near this movie.
The movie doesn't play Moneyball with the script, man. Right?
It should have.
Like, it's like conventional wisdom. We can't have no conflict. He's got to have greater stakes. If he's just,
right?
You know, if he's just some kind of rich entitled dude that doesn't really care if he wins or loses, he's got to have his daughter. Got to have his daughter on pins and needles about being homeless. For going from GMing a major league baseball to just being out in the streets. He's got to be sweating this. He's got to not stack up against the ex-wife's new husband. He's got, No.
To get like, rid of jettison all that, you got a much tighter, much better movie. And you can add a little bit more of the Moneyball stuff in, which I would have appreciated. Like I said, four hours, I could have done it.
I wonder if you get rid of Brad Pitt if the movie looks like that, because you're right. I think he is probably 20% of the movie's budget.
Yeah.
And this became a mid-level big budget because of his presence in it, which probably helps in a lot of things, marketing and all that kind of stuff. But like, if you get someone a little less expensive, maybe the studio doesn't push you to like, well, Brad Pitt's good looking. He's got to have this relationship. He's got to do this, and or no one's going to care. And if it's just, you know, because, yeah, ironically, the studio conventional wisdom, I think, made this movie. I think you're being harsh saying it's mediocre, because there's a lot of like great shots and good filmmaking. And the fact that this is a dry fucking subject,
this is essentially
a bunch of formulas and, you know, scientific programming jargon, you know, writing shit in Pascal and Fortran and stuff. Like, it's very boring. It's kind of like
it could be, yeah,
the way that I thought it's as good as what it was doing is like The Social Network was showing, like, you know, the spirit of hacking and hacking in the sense of just like kicking around code, not like breaking into things. I thought it was that good of showing these charismatic people doing this very interesting and obscure thing and like helping people understand what it was about, the old way of doing things and how this came into clash. Like, there's a lot of just this being in the fabric of the film and be pretty effortless. I think it's hard to make this inherently interesting, especially since
it is.
This is a nothing burger. This is not Rags to Riches. This isn't, you know, Bad News Bears that win the World Series. This isn't, it's kind of ends in a bummer, but yeah.
Yeah, I think they do a great job with that core concept. I just wish they wouldn't have tried. And Sorkin does this, right? Like, Sorkin's kind of MO is he takes these very heady, very difficult to convey or adapt to the screen concepts and runs with them and then adds the human drama. Like, he tried to do it in Social Network by framing the whole thing around the friendship of Mark Zuckerberg and what's his fuck.
Or getting spurned by the girl, which didn't really happen, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And some of that works. I feel like it's not his strong suit. His strong suit is translating very heady material into exciting drama in and of its own right. And I wish he would have stuck more to that in this movie and less of injecting the weird daughter stuff, the mixed messages. I think like, there's a weird title card in the middle of this movie that just says The Streak. When the, like, title cards haven't been a part of this movie ever, and it just kind of comes out of nowhere. There's a lot of strange stuff in this movie that doesn't quite line up, that just could have been done a little bit better. And to me, that means, you know, it all pans out to about a 6 out of 10 for me.
All right. Well, fair enough. Like I said, I thought it was pretty good from a life instruction, from just a well-acted, performed, and shot movie. Like, you know, they're doing a lot of stuff with multiple, you know, layers of isolation and lighting. They're doing good things just at the set and setting to kind of show, like, how ramshackle an outfit is versus how sophisticated another one is. And, you know, lots of famous, the Sorkin walk and talks are all fucking in this movie. Like, yeah. you'll get really familiar with the few yards of corridors in between the locker room and the coach's room and the train. And the, you know, the training room and the all that stuff, the sports medicine room, like the, yeah, this is like 30% of the movie takes place on foot, going from one of those scenes to another. Mm-hmm. But and it's also, like I said, this concept of Moneyball is transforming a lot of things in society. In fact, this advanced metrics, you know, is really exploded the stock market in the last few years, because a lot of these trades are now being done by sophisticated learning algorithms that miss, you know, that get these fractional advantages on, you know, fractional percentage points bouncing this way and just generating money out of nothing.
And trading so fast that literally if you're not next door to the New York Stock Exchange, you're not getting your order in fast enough to take advantage of the best trades.
Which, like I said, I don't know how I feel about that, because like I was never one of the ones in the stock market to say, oh, it's fake money and all that kind of stuff. But when you're doing some of this stuff where you're deriving value on margin calls and you know, some of the more, and again, just taking advantage of just tiny slivers of benefit to generate wealth without value.
I worry about literally that talking about the speed of light, the difference between the speed of light from your house, 2000 miles away to, to, you know, being next door to the building. It's wild.
Yeah. So like I said, there's a lot to unpack here to help you understand things that we're going through. It's also, again, you know, how to shepherd a controversial thing through a community and get buy-in. There's a lot of good stuff in this movie, and I think it's well worth watching, and it's entertaining too. Like, it's over 2 hours, but if I didn't know that going in, I'd have felt it was like a breezy 90. Even when it's like, the whole movie's slow and talky, but it's just really fascinating and interesting
for sure.
And here's the other things. I don't give a shit about baseball. Like, I like basketball. I really like football, but I've never give a shit about baseball. But like, I knew enough to, you know, not even really like the movie does enough to help me understand how these stats apply to this game and how the old way versus the new way, that I found it pretty easy to follow. Even if I couldn't explain to you what exactly happened, I knew kind of in the same way a good movie can sell you on action without you knowing, you know, necessarily where everything is and what's happening. It's just, you kind of get the feel and the flow. And I feel like the movie does a really good job of keeping you in that flow of being a fast talking, hustling, you know, baseball GM that's always looking for an angle. So that's us looking back at Moneyball 10 years into the past. This is something I've been wanting to watch for a long time. And I finally got a chance to, so I'm glad about that. Hope you guys enjoyed this prestige film. We'll be back next week. I'm not sure what we're doing because we're recording this in advance for the anniversary, but we will have something prestigious, something that doesn't involve ray guns and zombies and medieval times, unless it's a really good A24 film.
True.
Or Stanley Kubrick made it. Then it might have spaceships. We'll see, but probably not on the next prestige. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
I'll see ya.